So you're sitting around the holiday dinner table with your whole family and everybody is having a good time. They're even behaving. Nobody's talking politics, nobody's talking religion. Then somebody asks, "Hey Dad, did you ever get that colonoscopy you were supposed to get?" No, Dad has not gotten that overdue test done. In this, Dad is like a lot of American men. A lot. In our culture, many guys are notable for their extreme reluctance to go to the doctor, the dentist, or the x-ray lab. And they always seem to have an excuse.
Oh, it'll probably go away in a couple weeks or a week or whatever.
I have a primary care physician, but I couldn't tell you their name.
I'd rather just go research the problem myself and see if I can find a solution.
And even guys who know those alibis are nonsense, they still don't go.
I have no excuse whatsoever. I just don't bother doing it unless I have to. And frankly, a lot of times when I do go to the doctor is at the assistance of a woman in my life.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse traces the impact of scientific discovery, sometimes by looking back a few decades to see how far we've come, and sometimes by looking really closely at a pine needle to detect a vicious pest. The Pulse tells your stories of illness, healing, and dealing. We walk to work with people and sometimes get to feed their cats.
Innovation drives the creative economy.
It is the cutting edge of what modern neuroscience can do.
Brain injury survivors still are capable of doing many things.
I think there's a notion that researchers are in some sort of ivory tower.
This is my health.
We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter
out. In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
On today's show, the long road back from traumatic brain injury, the year's most inspiring science stories, and the perils of doing research in ice-cold conditions. But first up, men, doctors, and the women who get caught in between, trying so hard to get their guy to get that checkup. Elizabeth Perez Luna explored the issue for The Pulse, and her research started very close to home.
The men in my family, father, brother, husband, are different in many ways, but they're alike in one respect. They refuse to go to a doctor. Even when they feel lousy, persistently at times, they brush it off with an, I'm fine.
I'm totally fine.
No, I'm fine.
Then
I'm
head
fine.
To the drugstore to get an over-the-counter or something. And that's that. For years, my father would bring to the table a warm glass of water and dissolve the revolting brown pill. This was his remedy for a self-diagnosed nagging stomach problem that ended up really being a severe gallbladder infection. The women in my family spend an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out how to get the guys to a checkup. In this, we joined other wives, sisters, mothers the world over.
I saw something on my husband's face. I, of course, was worried about skin cancer, and I would point it out to him, and he would say, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Look at the other side of my face. You don't have to look at it." And I was
recently, I chatted about this problem with some of my book club buddies to protect the guilty. In other words, their husbands. We agreed I wouldn't name names. This is about caring, not blaming.
So eventually, by pointing it out to him every morning, he finally did go to the doctor.
Well, my husband doesn't go easily to the doctor. He makes infinite excuses. He's too busy. He hopes that a problem will just go away. So it does take a certain amount of nagging. I offer to make appointments for him. And he said, "Well, I have to check my calendar. I'll get back to you."
Whatever these women tried, talking, cajoling, threatening, leaving brochures in strategic places around the house, was mostly ignored.
So I find that using logic is probably not the best way to get to my husband.
So what is it with men and doctors? It's not lack of information. Popular websites ranging from mancave.com to Ask Men give solid health advice and try to point men to the doctor's office. One site, aimed at digital natives younger than 40, lists the common and lamest reasons for avoiding a checkup. "I don't like to be touched by a doctor. I'll tough it out. I don't trust any doctors." Ah, To see the full list, check out our website, whyy.org/thepulse. For the over 40 generation, some rather aggressive ad campaigns tried to get men to listen and get tested. In this public service announcement, a woman realtor congratulates a family for their new home and then looks directly at the man.
I'm sure you'll have many happy years here, except for you, because you'll be gone 3 years from now, struck down by the same disease that got your father, so you won't be around for them. And sadly, it could have been detected early with a simple test, but you didn't have it.
Ouch! All these efforts send the same message in more or less elegant ways. Get off your butts and do something about it. You might not be fine, you can't always tough it out, and if you have time to track your fantasy football team, you got time to do the doctor thing. Why do so many men ignore such obvious truths? Well, there are a few reasons for that.
Yes, men are invincible.
Says Dr. Michael Coachman at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital Gastroenterology Division.
We are the men of the house, and many still hold that to be the truth, that it will not happen to them because they're busy. And that it's a sign of weakness to go to a physician even when one is feeling well.
Most men don't go to doctors unless they're in trouble. Women are used to going to for gynecological checkups, and the gynecologist becomes their primary physician.
Chiropractor Basil Snayman.
What motivates men is pain and being able to do what they want to do. If you can get them to have their cake and eat it too, with minimal change in their lifestyle, they're in.
Well, maybe so. But it gets really complicated when you consider the intricacies of defining masculinity. Men are supposed to be strong, tough, resilient, hard workers, good providers, good lovers, partners, husbands, parents, and bosses. Exactly, says Dr. Coachman.
I think there is a not wanting to appear weak, not wanting to appear ill, and then especially for people that have either public jobs or are out running businesses, they don't want to give any appearance often, and that's difficult.
I went to the cardiac rehab center at the Lankin O Hospital Heart Institute to meet with some men who found out the hard way that they are not invincible. Under the supervision of physicians and specially trained nurses, they come here several times a week to relearn how to live after cardiac surgery. Their ages range from 55 to 80 plus. They agreed to share some of their stories, usually punctuated with some regret at not having listened to their spouses.
My first heart attack got me to quit smoking. My second heart attack had me lose 20 pounds immediately. If you ask my wife about it, that is a definite concern of hers on that, to keep my weight down.
What's the most difficult thing you had to give up?
I would say red meat.
Mm-hmm. Salt particularly.
Cakes.
Do you dream of little dancing cakes?
Oh, I'm originally from South Philadelphia, and I stop in all those Italian pastries, and I just used to go crazy over them. And just have to put it out of your diets, that's all. You just have to resolve yourself to it if you want to live longer.
The youngest man in the group, 55-year-old Scott Snyder, wanted to talk about the constant pressures of work.
With cell phones today and with MiFis and Wi-Fis, you're connected 24/7. To be honest with you, as I was rethinking it through, I think the greatest regret that I had was not setting boundaries, that this is work and this is my life and this is my health. It's very, very difficult to basically say, you know what, I'm going home. I'll deal with it in the morning. And that's tough. It's been easier to do it, you know, since my heart attack, but that's tough.
One of the benefits of the Lankin O program, they say, is that they can talk with other men and encourage each other to take care of themselves without always waiting for the women in their lives to pressure them. But it never gets easy to take that plunge, even for physicians.
There's a game that's played in every single corridor of every hospital.
Dr. Jay Siegfried, director of Lankin O's Cardiac Rehab Center.
And that is that you sidle up to your colleague who happens to be your friend, who probably shares many of your fears and shares medical knowledge in areas that you might not, and you say, may I curbside you? and then you ask the question that is bothering you or your wife has been hounding you about, and then you decide if you want to pursue it any longer. It's cheating a little bit because you don't have to make a full commitment to go see the doctor. You don't have to admit that you're sick. You can make it sort of could almost say, I have a friend who has this.
So are there any signs of hope for the women in my book club? Yes, says Dr. Michael Coachman. But changes in the health prevention field take time. They go hand in hand with a host of other issues, ranging from attitudes to access to affordable health care to strong public awareness campaigns. A good example of that?
With tobacco cessation. Is a good example of something that no one would listen to for a while. And now tobacco cessation is clearly one of the primary aims of primary internists.
The media are also offering men more honest talk about diet, exercise, and longevity in formats they like. Celebrities play a big role here.
The Katie Couric's of the world who are able to go out and speak about things are absolutely critical.
Even if men become more receptive to messages about prevention, women will probably remain for a long time in their roles as the family primary sentries and gatekeepers for health care. Here's comedian and talk show host Steve Harvey talking about that fact on a show that itself is a powerful platform for prevention messages, Dr. Oz.
You know, my wife does it for me. You know, she tells me how much the family's dependent on me, how much she loves me. How we can't, you know, how nobody's going to be able to live without me, you know. That's pretty good to know you're needed and wanted, and that usually gets me to the doctor, and, you know.
In the long run, says Penn physician Michael Coachman, it's still a question of personal responsibility.
And the idea that the doctor tells you what to do, that attitude really has to change. It has to become more of, I have an understanding of what's best for me. I have to act responsibly. Now, how you get to that level of cooperation and compliance is a difficult one to answer. I'm not sure how you get there, but the buck stops with the individual.
Yes, indeed. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go and elbow some of the men I care about. Don't you think it's your turn now? I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna for The Pulse.
We've posted a list of checkups and tests men are supposed to get at our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And let us know, what's the lamest excuse you've ever used to get out of going to the doctors? Or what's the lamest excuse you've ever heard? Tweet us at whyythepulse. In Philadelphia alone, there are more than 300 schools, and many of them have big, flat roofs. One company sees this as a golden opportunity for solar power. Zach Seward went onto a snowy Kensington rooftop for a view of putting school buildings to work.
Well, this is nice.
This is what it is. I mean, this is what every rooftop in Philadelphia should look like. Covered in solar panels, generating energy right where you use it. That's what we're about, point-of-use energy generation.
So that's Micah Gold-Markell, and he's the founder of the Philly-based company called Solar States.
Oh, my gosh, they're covered.
They're covered? Well, they're sort of covered.
That's a group of high school kids in the background there, and we're on the roof of a big old plumbing factory in South Kensington. It's studios and offices now, and in 2011, Solar States installed what was then the largest solar array in the city of Philadelphia. It's 444 solar panels, which power about half of the building.
So our job today is take the snow off of every... No, I'm just kidding.
That was right.
Gold-Markell's company has two missions. One, turn as many rooftops as possible into mini power plants. And two, teach kids about the benefits of solar with an eye toward building a green-collar workforce.
And our goal is, with the Philadelphia Solar Schools Initiative, that next year some of these students help us install in 20 schools throughout the city.
The Philadelphia Solar Schools Initiative is Gold-Markell's big new project. Solar States has turned to the crowdfunding site Indiegogo to raise money. The goal is to hire someone to connect with schools, and the idea is to lure outside funding to build these solar farms, with the schools getting the benefit of the power created and added curriculum around solar. Solar States is currently testing the educational part of the program. Up on the roof right now is a class of second chance high schoolers from the Youth Build Philadelphia Charter School.
I want to continue learning about solar panels.
That's Youth Build senior James Powell. He's hoping to be one of the guys who installs the panels on the 20 schools.
And I really want to take the initiative to actually do that because I think it's a good idea for other students, especially young students, to actually learn about the things that we've learned so far.
Motivating this generation and the next is the big picture goal. New numbers show that U.S. solar is adding generating capacity at a fast clip. Micah Gold-Markell knows that rooftops are great for the long view.
I tell this to the students. This is our opportunity. Look around. Open your eyes. This is it. All of these rooftops, I mean, are here and they're waiting for us to get up and put solar on them. And we just have to go out and do it.
The goal is 20 schools. So far, none have signed up, but Gold-Markell is confident he'll get there. After all, his business is sunshine. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
Coming up on The Pulse, 5 years ago, Brian Hickey left a bar to catch a train. He woke up several weeks later in a hospital.
It gradually comes back to you. Like where you are. I think it might have taken a couple days to acknowledge I was laid up.
The long road back from traumatic brain injury. That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, neuroscientist Sam Harris on the high cost of lies, even tiny ones.
It's the antithesis of integrity and openness and authenticity. And when you're pretending to be someone you're not, you're paying a price even if it's not obvious to you.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat some of the world's most serious diseases. With its U.S. headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, AstraZeneca operates in more than 100 countries, and its medicines are used by millions of patients worldwide. More at AstraZeneca-US.com or at the company's blog at azhealthconnections.com. AstraZeneca proudly supports WHYY's The Pulse.
Welcome back to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our next story is about a colleague of ours, Brian Hickey. He's an editor for WHYY News, and he is a serious Philadelphia character, a man with a hilarious Twitter feed. He's a great teller of true crime tales, a fan of Maury Povich, Katy Perry, and the FC Barcelona soccer team. 5 years ago, he suffered a severe brain injury and almost died. The fact that he's here today, writing, tweeting, joking, a devoted father and husband, was made possible by many fairly recent advances in science and treatment. We retraced his long journey, starting at the Patco train station at 8th and Market. It was Black Friday 2008, 5 years ago, and Brian Hickey caught the train to Haddon Township, where he was meeting some old friends at a bar.
I still have the ticket.
You do?
Yeah.
It's a round-trip ticket, but Hickey never made the trip back to Philly that night. By now, the ticket's expired.
So I can't use this, which kind of pisses me off. But
you want your return
260,
trip?
260 down the drain. Well, I don't know. The rates might have gone up since then.
After hanging with his friends for a while, Hickey left the bar around 10 that night. He was walking toward the train station on a dark street with no sidewalk. And that's the last thing he remembers.
The skid marks were right about here. And then they found me here.
The driver who hit Hickey head-on sped off.
A close-by resident heard a thump, and his dog wouldn't stop barking, so he went out to check. He found Hickey bleeding in the street. When paramedics arrived, Hickey was conscious and belligerent.
Where it's like, I'm fine, don't effing touch me, I want to go home, don't take me to the hospital.
They took him to Cooper Hospital, where his condition rapidly deteriorated. Meanwhile, his wife Angela had no idea where he was. She'd been frantically trying to call his cell phone when he didn't get home. By dawn, she had alerted Hickey's dad. Eventually, they learned he was at Cooper.
I went to the trauma unit, which is like a bay of beds, and they told me he was in a fight. So we didn't know what was going on, what happened to him. We had no idea. They didn't know either. So it was very confusing at first. Like, I knew he was in horrible condition. He was intubated. Like, they were measuring the pressures in his brain continuously.
The hospital team knew how important the right kind of care right away is for a traumatic brain injury. That's the first medical advance that helped Brian Hickey survive.
Early use of intracranial pressure monitors has been shown to help reduce mortality.
That's Brian Kuser, who leads the head injury program at McGee Rehab in Philadelphia. He says acute care hospitals now follow guidelines set by the Brain Trauma Foundation. The last revision dates to 2007, the year before Hickey's injury.
The surgeons are more likely to do early surgery to help relieve some of that pressure because the skull does not expand, and so as the brain swells, it can push up against the brain tissue and cause damage.
Or, as Brian Hickey puts it more colorfully,
craniotomy, double crani, where they cut two pieces of my skull out. If they didn't cut that out, my brain would have exploded inside the skull.
After that surgery, Hickey remained in a coma. He woke up in December, over 2 weeks after the accident, at McGee Rehab. At first, he couldn't talk.
And I don't know if I realized I couldn't talk. Because when you wake up, it's not like you're all there.
McGee neuropsychologist Todd Lewis remembers evaluating Hickey and talking to his wife, Angela, about an uncertain future.
Can I tell you that Brian is going to be who he was before this accident? No.
Lewis says family members are the most crucial allies in recovery.
I believe in always 100% honesty, always maintain hope, never take away hope, but always be truthful and honest. And we always talk about today. My other interventions with Brian were in really maintaining his level of safety.
Hickey was rambunctious. For example, he was trying to escape out of his zipped-shut safety bed.
Trying to get out of the bed with a half-paralyzed body and my helmet. I don't even know if my helmet was on. They tell me I was screaming at nurses overnight, like just waking up, flipping out.
Neuropsychologist Todd Lewis says this kind of behavior is fairly typical.
When people suffer a brain injury, very often they're impulsive and disinhibited because of the injury. Because the injury affects their brain in a way that people often will do things because of their lack of insight and awareness and becoming very impulsive.
Angela Hickey says during most of his stay at McGee, her husband had two modes, angry or blank.
Like, he was there, like, there were no emotions except for anger. He was just always flat.
Individualized therapy, refined by decades of practice and research, is the next thing that helped Brian Hickey recover. Hours of speech, physical, occupational, and art therapy helped him regain his most basic skills.
They literally had to teach him, like, what a pencil was and how to spell pencil.
The one thing that bothered me most when I actually emotionally broke down the first time was I wasn't able to write because half my body was paralyzed from the injuries, left side of my head, so my right side was paralyzed. So I couldn't write, and I'm a writer by nature. So that was when reality set in, like, whoa, like maybe you're not going to be able to live the life you lived before.
Hickey's tough personality was a help. He was determined to get better. He desperately wanted to leave the hospital and go home, so he set small daily goals, some related to his beloved pet.
My thing was, I want to be able to throw a tennis ball to Charlie Dog, so that's what they would keep telling me to do.
Todd Lewis says he encounters two types of patients.
One that you have to give a kick in the pants and get them going, and then one that you have to kind of pull back on the reins. If Brian fit into either of those categories, he was truly pulling back on the reins.
meaning he wanted to do too much too soon. Hickey recalled this interaction with Lewis during a recent visit to McGee.
You had me write an article for the newsletter. I don't know if it ever ran in any publication.
What was your thinking in trying to get Brian to write that story?
A couple things. I mean, I think, you know, to help him to see the improvements that he has made while also helping him to see that you still have work to do. So sometimes when you have somebody that is type A and gung-ho and I could go back to work tomorrow, I could drive a car tomorrow, I could live on my own tomorrow, sometimes insight is not something that you can just rehabilitate through talk therapy.
Ironically, one of the best things that we did was give him his cell phone back. One night I just left his cell phone with him, and he like started putting Facebook messages out. They didn't make sense at first.
On December 21st, 2008, he posted, "Brian Hickey gets off and certain trouble." From that moment on, you can track his improvement over time on social media. And that flat emotional state his wife Angela mentioned earlier, it changed.
One day I walked in and he was crying hysterically, listening to The Killers, which is like one of his favorite bands. And then that's probably when I knew.
In mid-January of 2009, Hickey left McGee. His father moved in to help Angela care for him. He rested. He read. He wrote thank you notes for those who had been there through his journey. He wrote a long article about his accident and started to work again. He became a father. And today, he says, he's mostly the same.
I may get frustrated if I can't remember something as quickly as I used to. Guess I get flustered from time to time. I don't think I'm any different, but maybe you'll have a clip to run immediately after that people saying how different I am.
He's not the same. I mean, it's not bad that he's not the same, but no, I mean, he's like has a much shorter fuse just about small things, and he can't remember things.
But that, she says, is such small stuff when she thinks back to the first hours after her husband's accident.
Everyone that saw him, they thought that he was done, gone.
The driver who hit Brian Hickey on Black Friday 2008 was never caught. Hickey keeps the bloody clothes that he wore that night in the trunk of his car as a small reminder that life can change in an instant. The race was on this past week as hundreds of thousands of people flooded the government's health insurance website trying to sign up for coverage that could kick in as early as New Year's Day. The Pulse's Alana Gordon has been following the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, and last weekend she sat with one man in Delaware County as he reached his goal, a new and cheaper policy thanks to some timely help.
The weather is unseasonably warm in downtown Media, but there's still plenty of holiday cheer.
God bless you. Sure, you tell.
People lounge around benches and tables in a cobblestone walkway near a main road. A few feet away, Caroline Pitcher sits inside a cozy coffee shop, laptop open. Pitcher has been highly sought after this holiday season. She's one of 9 certified healthcare navigators at an area agency tasked with helping people sign up for coverage through the new online federal marketplaces.
You could just read over this statement. Brian's the one that has to agree to it.
It says, I understand that because the premium tax credit will be paid on my behalf to reduce the cost of health coverage.
Today, she's meeting with 36-year-old Brian Kennedy and his dad, Dan Kennedy.
Scroll down.
Then you have to type in your name there.
Type in Brian Kennedy.
Dan's son, Brian, who's busy running a sober living residence, turned to him for help finding a plan. He doesn't have major health concerns, but was hoping to find a better option.
Just to lower my rate.
He had an individual plan, which is terribly expensive.
About $500 a month.
It hurts.
Yes, Dad helps. And he took advantage of his extra time in retirement to research plans. Fortunately for his son, Dad's also not your typical consumer. He's the former president of Riddle Hospital in nearby Delaware County.
Well, I was more in tune with what was going on, so Brian and I talked, and we decided it was an appropriate venture to look at what the options were.
But like thousands of other consumers, He also faced problems trying to sign up his son for coverage on his own.
I was so frustrated. I got dropped off the system so many times. It's difficult to get through it.
So he turned to Pitchers Group, Resources for Human Development, listed on the federal website as one of a handful of area agencies offering free in-person assistance.
Now I'm just going to go back to the enroll page.
Navigators like Pitcher are not affiliated with insurers. While she can help break down plan details and translate insurance concepts that might otherwise be confusing to the average consumer, she cannot recommend plans, differentiating her role from that of a broker. Brian's dad did for him a lot of what a navigator might do for folks without such support.
There's a lot of different plans, but you weigh the deductibles, you weigh the premium, you make the decision that's what's right, what do you want to pay up front, what do you want to pay at the back end through higher deductibles and copays. It's just doing the homework and then knowing exactly what's right.
Consumers like Brian may face a multitude of options to choose from. The average in Pennsylvania is more than 100 plans.
I'm lucky that I have a parent that has a little bit more time in his hands to help me in certain areas.
Pitcher, the navigator, says the plans are broken down into levels that make it easier for consumers to narrow down and compare. The differences being what portion of care a person pays out of pocket, the cost of the monthly premium, and how much a person pays entirely before insurance coverage kicks in. That's the deductible. Brian's dad also reviewed with him which doctor networks and drug benefits were covered by each plan.
So it's done now?
Yeah, you're enrolled officially with the marketplace, and the next step is to wait for the invoice.
Okay.
The two went with a silver-tiered plan, costing about $150 a month after subsidies, and with a $750 deductible. The plan is about $4,000 less annually compared to Brian's current plan. He turns to his dad.
Thanks for your help.
Dad turns to Pitcher.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks for navigating it, as I see where the name comes from.
Pitcher tells them they'll have until January 10th to pay the first premium, though coverage kicks in January 1st. She gives them the customer service number for the insurer they've selected. The process took about an hour. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You can find a resource guide for navigating these changes on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. When you live in an epicenter of scientific research and discovery, it's always possible that the woman standing behind you in line at the grocery store is spending her days researching a cure for cancer, or maybe she's searching for the origins of the universe. Wouldn't it be great to be able to just pick her brain? We offer just that opportunity in our segment, So What Do You Do?, where we pair up a layperson with one of our region's many scientists for down-to-earth conversations about their research. This week, Philadelphia writer and musician Christine Kennedy chatted with physicist Tom Geiser from the University of Delaware. Geiser spends a good bit of his time near the South Pole, where he works on a project called IceCube. It's a measuring station with thousands of sensors deep under the Antarctic ice, and it collects data on particles called neutrinos. Christine Kennedy is working on a film script set in Antarctica, so she really wanted to ask Tom Geiser,
what do you do?
We study particles using a detector called IceCube, which is at the South Pole. And IceCube consists of holes drilled in the ice with optical modules that are in the holes. And it's deep. It's the optical modules are between 1.5 and 2.5 kilometers below the surface. There are 5,400 plus optical modules, and they're on cables that are deployed in these holes, separated by 50 feet between each optical module. So it's a big thing. It's a cubic kilometer of instrumentation.
This array of modules is referred to as a telescope. Is that how you would describe it?
It's a funny sort of telescope. All of that is what we call it. And the reason we call it a telescope is that we're looking for neutrinos from astrophysical sources. And so the telescope comes in because we want to see something that hasn't been seen before, which is high-energy neutrinos from outside the solar system.
Okay, a mini physics lesson. Neutrinos are one of the fundamental particles that make up the universe. They have almost no mass and don't carry an electric charge, and because of that, they are hard to track down. Now, back to Tom and Christine.
Why does studying neutrinos matter to the everyday person?
I don't think it has any direct relevance to the, I mean, the kind of thing I do is hard to describe at a cocktail party. Well, it's always a problem because it's science we do for its own sake.
Why did you select Antarctica as your place of study?
There was an opportunity to do a high-energy cosmic ray experiment at the South Pole by putting detectors on the surface. And then Ice Cube came along, which was a proposal that many of us, it was a large collaboration, and we made this proposal to build a big detector, which is the present Ice Cube detector.
And how do you like working in the extreme cold?
It's fine. The National Science Foundation station is a very good place to work. You have nice warm clothes, and it's fine. The only problem is breathing, because you have to have some contact with the air. And then your glasses fog up and your nose gets frostbitten and things like that. But it's a nuisance.
You guys were there during a couple of holidays, like Christmas and New Year's. What do you guys do for the holidays?
People make it very elaborate. There's a race around the world, for example. Well, it's easy to go around the world at the South Pole because it's a pole and you just... But they make floats, like, out of bicycles, or people ski. And there's some serious runners who actually try to win the race. But it's basically just a nice party, I think.
Is there anything about our planet that you discovered in your research in Antarctica that you weren't expecting to find?
The thing about astronomy is learning how big the universe is. And you do see that in Antarctica, because there's nothing between you and the horizon. You just see as far as you can. So doing astrophysics from Antarctica helps you make the connection with how big the universe is.
Tom Geiser is a professor of physics at the University of Delaware who spends time in Antarctica for the Ice Cube project. Christine Kennedy is a Philadelphia writer and musician. Do you want to be part of our So What Do You Do segment? Tweet us at WHYY The Pulse. Coming up next on The Pulse, we discover a lot of skeletons in a Mount Airy basement, but they are there for inspiration.
Oh, the bones. Bones. That's the bone box. There's arms, legs, feet, hands.
That's next on The Pulse, here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is a global biopharmaceutical business focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat the world's most serious diseases. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our holiday week series with Mel Brooks.
Public radio, I mean, nobody's even paying for this. This is my career. I'm finished. It's over. I'm picking up cigarette butts.
Also, we hear from a comic Mel Brooks thinks is very funny, Amy Schumer. She writes, directs, and stars in Inside Amy Schumer on Comedy Central. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Being responsible to a moment and to a year that changed everything for a young filmmaker.
When something happens to somebody in their immediate circle, to somebody who looks like them, somebody who they can relate to, it's devastating, you know? I mean, it's something that marked our whole community.
Director Ryan Coogler on the making of Fruitvale Station. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott, and as 2013 comes to an end, we wanted to look back to some of the most inspirational science developments of the year. Joining us now is regular Pulse contributor Carrie Grenz. She's an associate editor with The Scientist, and she reads through hundreds of new studies every week. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Mike.
Carrie, 2013 was a busy, busy year in terms of great discoveries, so I'm sure you had a tough time finding a few to highlight.
Well, it's hard to pick among your favorites, but one story that I think has ramifications from academic labs to biotech companies to consumers was a ruling from the Supreme Court back in June. This was regarding a company called Myriad Genetics, and it had patented two genes involved in breast cancer. And the Supreme Court said, you cannot patent those genes. It fell back on the U.S. patent system, which says you cannot patent a discovery from nature.
So what does that mean now for science and research?
The idea is that, you know, more companies can enter the market sooner, potentially increasing competition and reducing costs. It also means that researchers might have more opportunity to do more research and development on patented genes.
Your second pick also has to do with genes with a genetic technique.
That's right. So this was a phenomenal year for molecular biology and genetics. And one of my favorite developments is something called CRISPR. It's an acronym. I won't go through it. But essentially, it gives researchers the opportunity to rewrite the genome any way they want. So they can go in to a very specific target in the genome and say, I want to fix this mutation right here, or I want to break the gene apart so that it doesn't work anymore. They can pretty much do whatever they want. This had major developments in 2013. Something like 50 papers, 50 publications came out regarding this CRISPR technique.
But how do they repair the gene? Do they put a new piece in, or when they rewrite it, how do they do that?
So you can introduce the correct DNA. You can allow for the cell's own repair processes to take place and repair it on its own as well. In the case of trying to develop a therapy, you could potentially rewrite a mutation that is causing a disease. And actually, researchers did show that in mice this year.
In mice, but not yet in humans.
Not in whole humans, no. We're still quite a ways from that. But in human cells, they have done it in human cells as well.
And I'm going to ask you to make a prediction. Are we going to see a lot more about that in 2014?
Oh, absolutely. I think you're going to see CRISPR everywhere. Instead of just being in a few specialty laboratories, I think it's going to be more and more common. And I think companies are going to take advantage of it as well.
All right. CRISPR, a term to remember for 2014. And your last pick in terms of inspiring developments has to do with funding for brain research.
That's right. So, you know, in the science community and in many other fields, 2013 was a tough year. We had the sequester, we had the government shutdown. And so there's been just a lot of constraint with government funds for basic research. But President Obama gave neuroscience some love this year by announcing what he calls the Brain Initiative. And it's pretty much to advance techniques to understand how the brain works.
And what exactly are scientists hoping to gain from that?
Sure. So there's a number of different agencies involved. The National Institutes of Health, for example, is dedicating $40 million to the Brain Initiative. And what the folks there want to do is look at the individual brain cells, the neurons, and how they talk to one another, and then how all of this chatter connects into the circuitry involved in health and disease. So really going from the basic level of the cell to neural circuitry and how cells talk to one another, and then how that affects our health.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor with The Scientist and a regular contributor to The Pulse. Carrie, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
If you have a disability and are under the age of 65 and living in Delaware, a new law about to come in effect could mean the end of mounting medical bills and, for some, a way to escape bankruptcy. Pulse contributor Sophie Reed is here to tell us more about it. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Mike. That's right. Up until this summer, people with disabilities on Medicare had 80% of their medical bills covered, but that still left patients to fork out a fifth of their costs. And insurers in Delaware weren't obliged to offer premiums to the under-65s to make up the difference. In some cases, it could mount up to crippling debts. I met a lady called Heather Block who was in exactly that situation. Now, Heather unfortunately has metastatic breast cancer, and what metastatic means is it spread to her organs. Heather's cancer can't now be cured and it can only be managed by treatment. Heather's been working for years overseas in some really dangerous places, helping other people. Unfortunately, her diagnosis means she can no longer work, and because her cancer can't be cured, she's now eligible for Medicare.
So how has that worked out for her being on Medicare?
Although Medicare covers the vast majority of Heather's bills, because she's under 65, she's going to have to pay 20% of the cost herself. Now, for a cancer patient, that can run into tens of thousands of dollars. And when Heather realized this could bankrupt her, she decided to take action.
What did she do?
She lobbied for a change in the law in Delaware, and I went to talk to her about it at her home in Lewis. She began by telling me how she was first diagnosed.
I was living and working in Afghanistan, and I noticed something physically wrong, and I came home for some tests. But I was told that everything was fine, so I went back to Afghanistan, and within a few more months, I knew that something was very wrong. I had to come home again. I was indeed diagnosed with breast cancer, and I went through treatment, and I thought I was cured. Unfortunately, within 2 years, it came back, and this time it was in my organs. It was in my liver and my lungs.
So despite facing an incurable disease, Heather decided to fight a second battle, taking on the insurers and the law in Delaware.
I realized that I will go on Medicare next year. So once I went on to Medicare, I realized that I could not get the supplemental insurance, the 20%, to cover my medical bills, and I would be bankrupted very quickly. I looked into other states, and I found out that there were a number of other states that did force insurers to cover disabled people. Delaware at that time did not.
Heather finally won her battle this summer when a new state law was passed. She can now buy a policy to plug the gap between Medicare and the cost of her treatment. Insurers no longer have the right to reject her because she's under 65. Heather told me that having something to fight for helped her cope with her cancer.
I have believed my whole life in taking action. The way that I worked was I threw everything at the wall and whatever stuck, I went after. Once I had a project, I felt good again. So I was ready to tackle this. I had a tougher time once it passed. So as soon as the governor signed it, July 15th, this past summer, I immediately said, oh my God, what will I do now?
Heather told me she hopes her actions will make a difference to other people with disabilities in Delaware.
Sophie, the new law goes into effect on January 1st. How many people will this affect?
It's not known exactly how many people are going to benefit, but it could be as many as 17,000 Delawareans who don't already get state help to pay that extra 20%. Although it's not clear how many of those people already get supplemental insurance, say through a spouse's policy or in some other way. But it's possible, potentially, that thousands could be affected.
And do we know anything about how much this kind of additional insurance will cost?
From what we found, the rates of these so-called Medigap policies vary enormously. At the bottom end, a basic policy might set you back $1,800 a year. But at the other end of the scale, you could pay over $6,000 for what's a comprehensive plan. As for Heather, the policy she's chosen will cost her just over $2,000 a year. That was the cheapest comprehensive coverage she could find.
Sophie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Maiken.
That's Pulse contributor Sophie Reed joining us to talk about one woman's mission to change the law in Delaware to allow people under the age of 65 to purchase additional insurance to supplement their Medicare. Medical illustrations in textbooks and journals have been teaching us about the inside of the human body for centuries. These days, much of that work is done solely with computers, but one Mount Airy medical illustrator blends the old and the new when he works, using both paintbrush and computer mouse. WHYY Health and Science reporter Carolyn Beeler has this profile.
Medical illustrator Burke Cox says reactions to his profession are pretty predictable.
Most people react to the work that I do with it. Ew!
But the illustration he's working on now, a delicate watercolor of the anatomy of the neck, isn't at all graphic.
What we're looking at is the side of a human neck. Visible are the ear and the jaw.
The painting is an intricate tangle of muscles and tendons, rendered with careful brushstrokes in a burnt golden color.
You got to get good brushes and good paper, because a good watercolor brush can make a line as thin as you want.
Cox clutches his tiny paintbrush as he sits at a massive table in his Mount Airy basement.
My studio, to use the term roughly.
His workspace is half drawing table, half computer desk. A jumble of paintbrushes, pencils, and erasers sit to his right. A computer and three different printers are across from him. When he's done with this drawing, he'll scan it into his computer and add a layer of fine detail and labels before sending it to his client. A shelf of anatomy textbooks cover one wall, a skeleton hangs not far away, and another sits crumpled in a box.
Oh, the bones. Bones. That's the bone box. There's arms, legs, feet, hands.
And skulls. Cox specializes in head and neck illustrations.
The most interesting skull that I have is this one, which comes apart. It's very handy for doing head and neck work because I can display only as much as I want to show of the interior of the skull.
Burke Cox fell into medical illustration by accident in his 20s. He was working for a researcher at a scientific institute in Portland, Oregon.
He needed illustrations, and he had a couple on his wall. I took a look at them and said I could do them.
Cox had taken art classes since he was a boy, but when he went to a liberal arts college, his path took a turn.
I wanted to do something that demanded rigor in academia rather than simply being able to draw.
In Portland, he found a career that combined the academic study of anatomy and pathology with drawing. By that point, though, he had 4 years of catch-up art and science classes and a master's program ahead of him. He says his passion for drawing kept him going.
I knew I could do it. You know, as long as there was daylight, I could keep on drawing.
More than 30 years later, he's still drawing. He mostly produces anatomical illustrations for medical journals and textbooks, but he particularly likes something he does less often, working with medical device companies to draw new inventions.
I found that I like being at the sort of the thin end of the wedge as far as science and development of ideas are concerned. I like being part of that whole system.
Years ago, Cox drew the lap band, the device now widely used in bariatric surgeries.
There's an old saying in engineering and in sculpture, if you can draw it, you can build it. And that's why they put me to work on it.
I'm Carolyn Beeler, WHYY News.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joe Patterson, our assistant producer, Megan Pinto, our executive producer. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.